Welcome to the Dental Business Podcast with your host, an owner of multiple businesses, a mentor, investor, and dental surgeon, Brad Thornton.
Hi guys, welcome to the Dental Business Podcast. It's Brad here. So we've got Adrian Dre on today. We interviewed a couple of weeks ago, I think, when a chat talking about data protection, sort of GDPR, must have been boring, right? Wrong, it wasn't. It's such an interesting conversation that we had because it's relevant to what you're doing every day as dental professionals. And you see the importance of it in a new and more engaging light when you listen to Adrian talk. We're going to be using him on a professional point of view, I think, because, I mean, this guy knows his stuff and he brings it across in an engaging and interesting way. Data protection, GDPR. Have a listen to this. Let me know what you think. Really good episode. Adrian Dre, here we go. Okay, so Adrian, thank you for joining us. Now, when I first sort of met you, and it might be interesting actually to initially talk about how we sort of met each other digitally, because I have spoke about Clubhouse, and I do think it's something that's going to take off. And we met in Clubhouse. And sort of knowing that you're to do with data protection, as a dentist, we understand what the significance is to what we do generally, because it's something that touches our profession every single day. There's elements of that we need to be aware of. But as I've kind of had conversations with you over these, last couple of weeks, I think, isn't it, that we've been chatting, I've actually learned more about how important it is and how it can influence business and it can trip you up and you can kind of find yourself in a little bit of trouble or there are things that can happen which people maybe aren't that aware of. So I thought I'd get you on just to talk about that, because I think there's some really interesting stuff that we've spoke about, and I think it's going to provide some good value for the listeners. But as a bit of an intro, do you want to just tell people sort of who you are, what it is within data protection that you do, and just a bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks ever so much, Brad. So I'm actually fairly new to data protection. Actually, most data protection officers or practitioners are kind of new to it, because GDPR was the biggest change in data protection legislation for generation. And before then, a lot of businesses didn't really take it that seriously, unless you're a bank or hospital, that kind of thing. But the general business, even though there was a law there, it wasn't the forefront of their mind in the way that other pieces of compliance like health and safety were. So when GDPR was being talked about, like 2016, I thought, well, this might be something interesting to look into. And I could tell already there was a wave of misinformation that was coming in. And my background is actually in education and also quite highly compliant environments. So I worked for the police, I worked in sort of anti-terrorism departments and that kind of thing in my early 20s. So I'd already got that sort of, the DNA of keeping to the rules and compliance and that kind of thing, because it's really, really important, especially around data. So when things came up with that, I sort of stumbled across dentistry by mistake, really, because I wanted to help a group, and I wanted to really get to the way I learn is by people asking questions, and I go out and research it. And as I'm researching, I'm learning about it. And I came across a Facebook group called GDPR for Dentists. It actually was run by Derek, who's been on your podcast before, Ignite Growth. And then it was only 200 people, and it ended up growing up. I think we ended up archiving the group, nearly 4,000 members. And during that time, just before and just after GDPR was implemented, and I was working for a consultancy at that time as well, is that we were able to get rid of a lot of these myths that were generally across all industry, but also where dentists have been misinformed by the sources that they usually go to for changes in compliance. And we weren't the biggest fan of some of those groups, but at least it went a long way to help dentists not to fall into the trap that have been put out there, whether, obviously unknowingly, that would actually cause massive disruption to their business. So from that, and I kind of got many data protection people do, they get quite obsessed with GDPR. I've told you before, my wife calls herself a GDPR widow because it became my life, during this time, and sort of wished I'd picked up FIFA like her friend's husband's. Yeah. So I became quite obsessive, but also I got a massive, you know, appreciation for dentists that are time poor. They're juggling chainsaws on a tightrope over Niagara Falls. You know, it's just constantly the next thing after the other. And I thought, I want to try and take away a lot of that pressure. And I was able to do that from the group. I then ended up consulting a couple of years, which is several couple of years, with a dental corporate. So I went from, you know, dealing with a dental practice with maybe a few tens of thousands of patients to millions of patients. Yeah. But having a look at it and seeing how it works, the nuances of dentistry, was quite interesting. And where I didn't have the appreciation that actually, you know, dentistry is quite a unique sector. I quickly learned that actually you've got to learn about dentistry. You need to know about the GDC. You need to know about NHS, all these different things for it to be applied correctly. And so, you know, I know my upper right six to my lower left two or whatever, those sorts of things. All that additional clinical information I've gained has been very helpful in actually applying this, particularly as the legislation has evolved and so have the fines come out and the compensation claims, all this kind of stuff. And some dentists are starting to feel the heat on that. So that's where I've come in, you know, to be the person that people can turn to, really.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said something there, because you said that, you know, you need to know dentistry to understand where it's relevant or where it applies. I think one of the things when the GDPR came out, it was like almost like carte blanche rules, buff. And maybe people just adopted certain things or adapted the business and were worrying about how they were going to, you know, tell a patient they were due for their next checkup. You know, how are we going to do that? Because they've not ticked the box. That kind of implementation of certain rules, but managing to kind of filter them through into your, you know, your sector's specific rules. You know, I don't even know whether people, you know, are still thinking about that. I certainly hear it on the grapevine where certain questions get asked and you think, well, hang on, wasn't that dealt with a few years ago? Didn't people realize that you can do that? You know, you mentioned there about sort of feeling the heat. I know we spoke because I was telling you about how I've, you know, potentially got plans to maybe buy some practice, and I'm in the talks at the moment with someone to acquire. And you were talking about how this kind of thing's quite an important factor to look at when you are looking at buying a business or taking over an existing dental practice. Do you want to kind of sort of elaborate the kind of things that you might look for, what might trip you up, why it's important?
Yeah, exactly. Before I go into that, I'd just say that, you know, one of the big failures of a lot of dental protection consultants is they go on about the fines. You know, is a dentist going to be hit by a 20 million euro fine or whatever the, you know, the sterling equivalent is that now? No, they're probably not. But so if we take the fines out of the picture, what are the burning issues here? And one of the things that's really important, I understand this from, you know, from corporate level to independent practice owner level, is how's it going to make the value of, how's it going to interact the value of my business? Or if I'm looking to buy a business, do I need to really give serious consideration over this as part of that acquisition? Because I don't want to pick up, you know, a term that I haven't coined, but I use it quite a lot, a data lemon. I don't want to pick up something that's got a heck of a lot of bodies buried underneath it. And so whilst, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, data protection was probably part of the due diligence process of acquiring a practice, or, you know, selling a practice, it is far more so now, because it could have huge reputational damages to that business. It could mean that you pick up something that's got, and I'll go into what those things might be, has got so much work to do. Actually, thinking, flipping heck, I knew about this beforehand. I may have had a bit more change of mind on the price of actually buying this in the first place. And also, one of the main things is, you know, if this business has had some issues, even if it's not gone into the papers, they haven't had the reputational damage, but are they on the ICO's radar? Because the ICO have got a very, very and that's the Information Commissioner's Office, the regulator for data protection in the UK. They've got a very, very interesting and very well-oiled machine when it comes to their intelligence, because they get breaches and complaints coming in thousands every day, but they've got their hit list. And it's thinking, I don't want to, even a small business can be on that hit list, particularly if they're processing special category data, that being health data. So when to answer your question directly, one of the main things that I would be particularly careful of when you're looking to buy a practice is their record management. Because historically, record management has been poor across healthcare, but dealing with both you know, sort of the GP side of things and dental side of things as a consultant, dentistry is not been great. They haven't been flying the flag of good record management. So it's not, you know, I expect some of your listeners might be thinking, I've seen this before. It's not uncommon to think that there's a garage that's got boxes of records in, paper records from decades back, because Deirdre in the village has been going to the practice every 6 months for the last 30 years. So you still got her record. So the checkup that she had in 1976, they might still have it. You know, it's part of her record. Does it have any relevance for ongoing treatment? I'm not a clinician, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't. So the issue it could be is like, if you're about to buy that practice, you want to find out what's their paper record situation like. Or did they go through a flurry of trying every kind of practice management solution, system R4, exact, you know, all the blah, and they've got a server for each that's full of data and unencrypted. Those sorts of things would be my first thing, because if you do have that, when you buy it, sooner or later you're gonna have to start sorting it out. Because one of the main principles under data protection law is not storing data longer than necessary. So if you do breach that data, the first question is going to be asked, well, should you have had it in the first place?
Yeah. And on that, you know, we spoke about this yesterday, wasn't it? When we were chatting about this episode, when you mentioned about having data longer than is necessary and having records longer than is necessary. You know, I've, you know, been a principal for 10 years and I got it hardwired in my head, like 10 or 11 years, that we need to keep everything in. You know, I'm in the office now, and to my right, we've got a room full of models. I know down in the cellar, there are paper records. There are models and whatever there are, you know, that relate to people. Now, if you ask me to find a patient's model, I'd find it eventually, but it'd take me a few weeks probably.
Yeah.
But you've got this kind of internal sort of fear that if you don't and something happens, now, whatever the something is, I don't know. Actually, we do know, and I'm sure you'll mention this. So we need to keep it, but you're saying that actually there's a different way to look at it, and maybe that's not the right way to look at it.
It's an interesting thing, because when one of the main questions that came up was, how long do we keep records for? I saw that all across, you know, our GDPR for Dentists Facebook group and other practice manager groups. And 10 years to come up, 10, 11 years. And people say, it's a legal requirement. It's against the law if you don't keep it for that. Or you do. And the thing is, actually, when I started researching it, I'm thinking, I need to find out where this 10-year thing's come from. And it comes from the statute of limitation around medical devices, so where people can put a claim in. And therefore, the reason why a practice has got good reason to keep records for a longer period than maybe what is relevant to the person's ongoing treatment is because you need that for a legal defense. So when we're living in a world now where you've got dental negligence solicitors that are, you know, they're in full gallop, aren't they, against the sector, you've got a good reason to keep it. But then you have to get to a situation like, okay, well, I have to keep records because it's relevant for someone's ongoing treatment. I don't want to get rid of, you know, an X-ray that was taken within 12 months because there could be a radiation exposure. I've got an NHS contract and I've actually contractually obligated to keep that. In the moment, NHS England, I think it's 2 years, and I think they're looking to relook at that. But beyond that, the only reason I need to keep it is to establish an illegal defence. So as a principal of a practice, whilst you are not directly liable for the for the treatment that's been conducted by one of your associates, you've always got this concern of vicarious liability there. So those records are could be your bulletproof vest sometimes to keep. So this is something I brought up with the ICO, because you have to balance what's the most important thing here. Is it I've got something that I can keep that's going to be relevant for a legal defence, or the fact that I don't want to be infringing one of the main principles of the regulation. And it goes back to the thinking that yes, you could justify it, and you could say I need to keep this for so many years because I could get sued, Your Honour. But can you say, yeah, that box of records got stolen, and I can't really say whether I should have kept it. And that's where the decision, and that's something that, you know, is a ongoing piece that I keep mulling over in my brain. But it does need to be some it does need attention. I think it needs attention from the GBC and others to kind of say, right, what we're going to say is this, particularly as you're moving from paper records to digital. Yep. It needs to be sorted out, because the current 10 years since the person's last appointment, I think is dangerous. I think it could be in it falling foul of breaching data protection legislation, which is worse than if you don't have that one bite wing from 1994.
So the kind of that, like you said, that balance is the difference between us having the models up here and, you know, the cleaning company changing and a new cleaner coming, cleaning the office, managing to get access to where they are. Mm. And then, you know, that's like a data protection breach, or thinks that they're rubbish, throws the files out or whatever. They end up in the local skip.
Yeah.
So the kind of the balance between having, you know, records at 10 years old that happens to, and basically finding yourself getting bollocked and whatever by the ICO, balancing that against what is the because I didn't realize that. I just thought, like you said, that it's the law. You know, you've got to keep these records. But if that number's been plucked out of the air because of this legislation that allows somebody to sue you due to negligence in relation to a medical device, then to me, it doesn't seem like it's worth keeping them for that long once they're deemed to be not relevant anymore, if that makes sense. Yeah. So it is definitely something. Did you mention that something in the NHS has changed? There's been a modification to some kind of guidelines?
Yeah. So there's, in 2016, the NHS released a document called the Record Management Code of Practice. And this is something that is adopted across all NHS England organisations, so mental health trusts, big hospitals, GPs, but it also applies to dental practices that run an NHS contract. But even the private ones, you know, it still holds its weight there. And at the back of that document, it's got a schedule of how long records should be retained for. And in some cases, they will actually make reference to the law that it relates to. So for example, around financial records and employee records, that kind of thing, you've got is a little bit stronger and clearer cut on why you keep it for so many years. Now that is interesting, actually. Sometimes, you know, we see this often with the NHS. When they release that document, they said they'll be reviewing it quite regularly. Regularly would be sort of later 2020, where now there's a draft version. And one of the things I went straight to, being the saddo that I am, is the retention period for dental records. And where the last one said 10 years since the patient's last appointment, the current draft now says 6 years. Okay. And in line with the NHS contract. So we know the NHS contract's being reviewed at the moment. So whilst I would love to say this is how long you should keep it for, I would say keep an eye on that. But that gives you an indication, 6 years, of what seems to be relevant. Yeah. So there's lots of little factors here. You know, the NHS thing, You've got the fact that dental negligence and solicitors, they're asking for records going way back. You know, I know one of the big names, which I won't mention, you know, they've got massive success rates for payouts to their clients based on records that were over 10 years old. So it's an interesting one. I wish I could say, this is what it says, this is the guidance, this is what the GB said, but I can't at the moment, but I beg that it comes soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned about sort of these solicitors that the dental version of ambulance chasers, the ones that are kind of, you know, whatever, you know, you're looking for, they kind of try and find anything they possibly can by trawling through records, don't they? Yeah. Now, if you were to say to them, well, you know, our internal policy is actually that we hold records for 6 years, 7 years, so we don't have those records anymore. Because obviously, if that's the case, you know, can they do? I mean, is there a downside to that? I mean, I'm not sort of suggesting that you lie about it, but if you've got rid of them, then where does someone go with that? Then what would they do? Would they just, I mean, I know you're not a lawyer, but surely the lack of evidence would then suggest that the case is gone. It's just, you know, there's nothing to back it up.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but, and often it is a case by case. What I can say is that if you're unable to provide records that they expect that you would have, prepare to be challenged on it. And it's interesting, actually, I did a Clubhouse room on this yesterday about GDPR and dental negligence solicitors. And the kind of the topic of the group was really that these solicitors are banking on the fact that dentists don't know GDPR. And what you typically find is that dental negligence solicitors will put in a record request. So they're gonna ask for something, and they use GDPR, and this is completely legal. You know, it doesn't have to be the patient that puts in those requests. They can authorize a representative to do it, but this is the first step. So they'll put this record request in, and they'll ask for, you know, everything under the sun. So sometimes quite overreaching with it. Now, if you're providing, you know, a clinical R4 record that talks about a radiograph that was taken in 2013, and actually your practice didn't have digital radiographs until, you know, 2018, let's say, and when you submit that information to them, that patient, that clinical record, you don't have that bite wing from years ago, they will say, well, where is it? This is a key part of our case. Or it might be it's not a key part of their case and they don't ask you for it anyway. Now, under data protection law, if you're provided you receive a subject access request or a record request, whether it's from the patient or their authorized representative, you've got to find it. It's not, that's why you've got a month to do it. If it's a case that you've got, it's in the cellar somewhere, and you've got to go through a lot of records to try and find it, then you've got to go and try and find it and provide it. But as we know, you know, if there's been a history of bad record management across the sector in general or that particular practice, even with the most, you know, earnest attitude to try and find it and you can't, you're going to have to say, we've spent so many hours, we've checked our archive, we can't find it. You know, we're looking for it like it's a £1 million check with our names on it. We can't find it. And that's what you would need to produce. And I always say to dentists, you're in that position. If you're worried because you can't find it and you've really looked for it, documented what you've done to try and find it, because you will be challenged. What you should never, ever do, in fact, it's a criminal offence under the Data Protection Act, is think, see that radiograph and think, oh, clinical note, think, oh, that doesn't look, that's not going to play in our favour. Where's the shredder, Julie? Because if you block or you deliberately try to disrupt that legal process of an information right, it's a criminal offence. And the ICO have actually started, you know, they're publishing on their website people that have done this, people that have deleted something, and there's been evidence around it. Has that happened to dentists yet? No, but be very, very aware that it is a possibility.
And another thing you've mentioned as well, which again I think is a good thing for people to be aware of, that you know there are some people that are you know acting maliciously to try to trip dentists up, and you know like the phishing scams or the ransomware. You know that there are people that are out there that are actually trying to find breaches in your data protection GDPR or whatever, whether it's on your website, whether it's whatever, and they're actually using that as leverage, aren't they? So that, you know, it's something that's becoming more popular, I say popular, becoming more common. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So you've got three parties, three types of bad actors, as we call them. You've got the hackers that are out there, and they're looking at every type of website, and they're looking for vulnerabilities. And if you think of it from their perspective, you know, medical data is quite valuable, actually, on the dark web. So they're going to try on, you know, there's a lot of automated processes where they will be doing certain attacks on websites and that kind of thing. So making sure that you've got good security on your website. You know, I run a survey on a website that picks out, you know, critical things that need to be sorted out, because hackers are lazy. You know, if you've got the main thing, they'll just go on to the next one. They'll go to the practice down the road who hasn't got the security certificate. So you've got those guys, and they're always going to be there. Then you've got, and I hate to say it, privacy advocates. So people who know GDPR, they're not hackers, but they're doing something similar, and they are looking for privacy infringements on people's websites. So, you know, for example, you know, have the cookie banner that pops up, and you've got accept cookies, so you don't, you know, you're not going to have any tracking until you accept it. If that doesn't function correctly, and to be honest, most websites, it doesn't function correctly, these guys, sort of privacy champions, they call themselves, will say, you've got a problem with your website, you're tracking me, and these are not patients. These people wouldn't know you from Adam. They then send you this threatening letter saying you've got 30 days remaining. I mean, it's borderline blackmail. And then if you haven't removed it, then you get hit by a compensation claim, or it goes to a small claims court. So I'm helping a dentist at the moment defend that, because the guy who's put this claim over, I mean, he sent this long, long email. I mean, you know, I like data protection subject. It was boring me by the end of it. But, I, you know, thankfully, we've been able to sort of win as much as we can that case, because we've just basically said to him, this does not meet the threshold of seriousness for you to get compensation out of it, you know.
Yeah.
But to be honest, you know, most business owners, if they saw that and they saw fines and ICO and GDPR, they'll think, well, £500 to make it go away, of course I'm going to pay it. And this particular individual I know has succeeded in that way. And then the last sort of bad actor are patients that have started to weaponize GDPR, because they've seen these things online, they've seen it on TV, data breach compensation lawyers. And if they have a feeling that you've said something to someone else about their treatment, or they may have a valid reason for it, Brad. So I can't necessarily call them bad actors, but there are people that are chancers that will try it on. And I wrote a blog about 3 years ago called GDPR, the Next PPI. And I really don't want to be a I told you so kind of person around that, but unfortunately that is a thing now. But the thing is that, again, a bit like those privacy advocates, a lot of these sort of claims that come through from patients, they've had a bit of GDPR knowledge, they've done a bit of research on Which magazine, and they think they're a know-it-all. But when they come at you and they start talking about GDPR compensation, GDC and that kind of stuff, as a principal, you're quite rightly to feel a bit panicked about it, because it's something you've not come across. So those are the three main areas, really, which is the nasty side of it. I don't agree. I believe people need to be compliant with the law and respect people's privacy rights, and it's a human right as well. I don't like the people that to take advantage and weaponize a regulation to make life difficult for small business owners.
Yeah. So in terms of certain key things, then, you know, you've been working sort of within the dental industry for a little while, but you see, you know, you've had quite a big exposure to big business and smaller business, corporates to individuals and whatever. Are there sort of like key takeaways or very specific things that it's like, right, I'm going to come into your practice. These are the things that I'm absolutely going to first look at making sure that you're doing correctly. Have you got like a hit list, top five, the main ones or anything?
Yeah, I'll try and keep the three, I think. The main thing is culture. Culture is so important. If you don't have that from the top, you might as well just give up. And what I mean by culture is not everyone has become a GDPR expert, but you've got the principal that takes it seriously because he realizes that the implications are real. And when I say implications, I don't mean the 20 million euro fine. I mean the fact that reputational damage, that people talk about these things, the time it's going to take to sort things out, you know. And when you've got that and an understanding of that, and you're able to express that to the rest of your team in a constructive way, you've sorted out a lot of the battles already. And particularly over sort of data breaches, vast seems to be the percent of people say about things, but it's around that figure of data breaches being caused due to human error. So whilst you could have spent, you know, thousands of pounds on security, it could be John who sends the email that's got someone's medical history and they're HIV positive to the wrong person. Yeah. Is the thing that's going to get you stuffed up. So culturally important. So making sure that everyone, including your associates in the practice, have regular data protection security training. Now, the NHS provide one for free, the e-learning training. I've done face-to-face training, and I'm looking to sort of bring it to sort of 2021, you know, and look at some of the things that happened so it actually lands correctly with all members of the practice team. But if you can get that sorted, people just taking 10 seconds to think, okay, I've got a really sensitive email here that I'm going to send. Let me just check it's properly encrypted. I'm sending it to the right person, all that kind of stuff. But the only reason they'll get that, or maybe there are two reasons, is A, they've been properly trained, or B, they've recently done it and they felt so sick to their stomach, they're never going to do it again. And, you know, I would admit, even I've sent an email to the wrong person. And I, you know, I'm a data protection professional. I'm supposed to be the white knight that never does anything like this. And I got in trouble, you know, with the ICO about it. It wasn't particularly bad, but they said, you know, you need to know. And you know what? When I send an email now, I feel like I'm defusing a bomb. But it's true. You know, the culture has a really, really big impact on things. The second thing that I would strongly recommend to all practice owners is make sure you do your due diligence on the partners you're working with, your supply chain that handle personal data on your behalf. Because you could have everything that's right internally, you could have all the training, security and that kind of thing. But, and especially as we're going to more cloud environments now, is that you want to make sure that you're satisfied that they're going to be handling personal data, patient data, and obviously don't forget your staff's data properly. And there's two ways that you can do that. First of all, under data protection law, you need to have what's called a data processor agreement. So, for example, if you're using a shredding company, you want to make their handling data. They're going to take it away and they're going to destroy it. Okay, so that agreement, that's got legal clauses in it under the Data Protection Act. But that's the thing that the first thing you're going to be asked by the ICO, if that shredding company calls you up one day and says, those two bags of medical histories that you gave us, we've lost them. Someone went to the yard. First thing you need is that data protection agreement. And make sure it's dated as well. The second thing that you need to do is a due diligence piece. So it varies based on risk. So if you're going to say a cloud-based practice management solution, let's say I'm not going to mention any names here, but say you're going from your usual server to now cloud-based, so they're holding this information for you. You want to do some basic due diligence. So I have, you know, questions that I put forward. I review them on behalf of my clients, and I say, yeah, this is okay. let's go back to them, but let's keep an eye on them every year and make sure that they are keeping to that data processor agreement that I just mentioned. The reason why that's important is the ICO first. Why did you engage with this particular organization? What did you do to check them? Do you have the agreement? Blah, 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 blah. And from there, if you're able to say, look, we are as surprised as you are. We've done all this. This is what we've done. The ICO will actually say, well, okay, thank you for that. We're going to leave you be. And we're going to put enforcement action against the processor only. And that's a new thing under data protection law. The old law meant the controller took the whole hit. Now the processor can be hit independently. But that requires the controller to really be able to show they've actually done their due diligence on them and they've got that agreement. And then the third one I would say is really important is around sort of security. So in data protection law, you know, you've got the privacy side of things and then you've got security. And, you know, earlier I said that hackers can get, they're quite lazy sometimes. You know, if they see that you've got some of these certain locks on the doors, they'll go away. And you can get some really easy locks now that can stop entirely preventable data breaches. So, for example, if you're using a system that has multi-factor authentication, a little bit like your banking apps, you know, it sends you a text message so it knows you, use it. Passwords. Make sure those passwords are complex. If the PIN code on the practice mobile is 1234 and they lose that phone, guess the first PIN number that someone's going to try. Okay. Making sure that associates are using their account to go into the practice management system. And they're not just using the receptionist or the nurse's account. So you can actually see who's using what. So there's no sharing of passwords and that kind of thing. These are very basic things, but things that easily get forgotten about. The other one is making sure your software is up to date and generally, you know, good physical security as well. Locks, cameras if you need to. I'm not a big fan of CCTV. I think a good alarm and a plenty of alarm signs is enough to keep people away. And making sure wherever your records, your paper records are, they're not going to get stolen. They're not going to get compromised or damaged or that kind of thing. So those are sort of the three, I mean, there's lots of other areas, but those are three areas I think if you've got those sorted, that's half the battle.
You know what? That's absolutely spot on that. To say that, you had no idea that I was going to ask you that question. That was so well-rounded and specific to the kind of stuff that somebody... as a dentist and a practice owner, you know, you're thinking to yourself, you know what, they're actually really important things to make sure that we're sorting out and we're kind of, the thing about culture is actually a really good one. And I think sort of, you know, as I'm processing that, I think just staff understanding, realizing, you know, the way they need to behave as part of a professional environment, you know, people that are new that might come in and they're working on reception and they're privy to certain bits of information or, you know, they might be talking about something or handling data. And like you said, that culture, and even though we tell people and you hope that there's an element of training and onboarding, it's kind of really important to kind of drill down and reinforce and revisit on a regular basis. And I've written down those points that you mentioned. I think that's something I'm going to mention. That I've got a practice meeting next week. I'm going to bring this up, actually.
And unfortunately, I mentioned a couple to you. I've seen the really horrible, scary stories, you know, that have hit dental practices. And thankfully, actually, I mean, I say scary stories, that they could have been very scary. But thankfully, the receptionist, because of their training, sense that something wasn't right. They could tell this person was disingenuous, and they were trying to get some information that they weren't entitled to. And they thought, you know what, I'm going to give you a call back. They called my team when I was working for a particular corporate. And I tell you what, I had full body chills and nearly burst into tears because I was so glad that they had actually thought ahead and that they were able to approach us and we were able to sort it out. It's brilliant. And it's difficult with the culture thing because they feel like they've got to want to do it. So where you do have these particular near misses, applaud the data protection champions within your organization, no matter how big or small you are, because that actually makes other people think as well, thinking, you know what, whilst I don't want to be in that situation, I'm glad that my boss appreciates it when I handle it correctly.
Yeah, brilliant. You know what, I think this is going to be a really good place to tie things up. I think what I'd, you know, people that are listening to this, and I'm going to obviously pay far more attention to this, and, you know, we're going to talk about it in the next practice meeting, and, you know, I'm going to actually get in touch with you about some bits and pieces moving forward. But for anybody that does want to find you, I know you've, I think you've got some future business things that are happening, but, you know, if I want to find you and hire you, like, where do I go? Like, where do I find you?
Yeah, I mean, I've gone from being working with the corporate, now starting up my own sort of private enterprise to help smaller practices. So hopefully by the time this has been published, my website is consulthere.co.uk. And if you put that into Clubhouse, if you put that into Instagram, or if you're a member of Dental Practice Management Solutions Facebook group, that's where I post a lot of things. So my main areas really is training to really be there when things go belly up, because, you know, I had quite in-depth training, but it's until I had, you know, it's the battle scars that taught me things that you'll never get in a course. So yeah. I want to be there to say someone calls up and they're freaking out because they've had this, you know, you're kind of right to be worried, but we're going to help you through it. I've got some contacts. Let's get through it and let's document things. And that advice is insured. And that's the difference with others, is that I'm a data protection professional. I've got indemnity insurance. I'm pretty confident in what I can say to people without being arrogant about it, but I've got, it's insured advice. And I think for a principal, that's worth its weight in gold. Yeah. I hope so. And I know it's helped those that I've helped so far.
Brilliant. Right. Well, we'll be, I mean, me and you are going to be talking in the morning on our Clubhouse morning. And for anybody listening that is on Clubhouse at the moment, 7 a.m. sort of UK time, we've got morning huddles where we have some pretty, you know, good speakers that are dropping in, aren't they, and people talking about some good topics. The last one was to do with brand and marketing, and the next one is to do with reception and how that affects the patient journey and that kind of, you know, front of house, sort of the importance of that. So yeah, if anyone's on Clubhouse, come and find us. If you're not, make sure you get onto Clubhouse, because I do believe it's the next big thing. So Adrian, I'm going to stop the recording there. Stay on the line though, because I'm going to have a chat with you.
But
thanks for your time, and I'll be seeing you tomorrow. For those listening, we'll check in next week. And that was Brad Thornton, Adrian Day on the Dental Business Podcast.